Thank you, John, and welcome everyone. The focus of much of the news coverage in Afghanistan, of course, is on the question of the continuing battle to track down the remaining al-Qaeda, the security situation, concern over warlords, all of which are, of course, the first priority. One of the things that, as has happened in other post-conflict situations, seems to be only somewhat slowly dawning on many in the international community, is that a focus on the rule of law and the justice system, issues of law and security, become a close second if there is going to be any hope for a stable, viable peace in the country and actual economic development and the resumption of some form of normality. We have today four speakers who are extremely well qualified to share with us a range of views on the current status of efforts to rebuild the justice system in Afghanistan and to attempt to identify directions for the international community, where we need to be going, where the priorities need to be set as we move forward in the coming months. Our first speaker is Jamal Benamar. Jamal serves as senior advisor for the United Nations Development Program, a position he's held since 1999. He serves as head of the Government and Rule of Law Unit and advises UNDP on a full range of issues pertaining to peace and security, including confidence building and peace building efforts worldwide. Previously, Jamal served as head of the Technical Cooperation Unit for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. Before that, he served as director for human rights programs at the Carter Center. I think that's when we first started dealing with each other. Prior to that, he was team leader for the Research Department for Amnesty International for 6 years in London. He was an associate professor at the University of Paris. His academic training is focused on international human rights law, includes legal studies and degrees at the University of Morocco and Sorbonne, a PhD in economics and political science as well. Our second speaker is Lisa Dickieson. Lisa currently serves as director of the Asia Law Initiative of the American Bar Association, a project that provides assistance and support of legal reforms and the rule of law in the countries of Asia. Previously, she served as deputy director of the AVA's Central and Eastern European Law Initiative, or CELI, which focuses on providing similar assistance throughout the former Soviet Union and Central and Eastern Europe. She developed and directed CELI's judicial reform and institution building programs. Prior to that, her first assignment for CELI was opening its office and developing its program in Macedonia in early 1993. Lisa previously practiced law for two firms in Washington, D.C. until joining the ABA. Our third speaker is Paul Seals. Paul currently serves as senior associate at the International Center for Transitional Justice in New York. Paul started out as a solicitor in Scotland, focusing initially in private practice in the area of criminal law. And then served with the United Nations Center for Human Rights in Geneva. He returned to Scotland as legal director of the Scottish Refugee Council, specializing in asylum law. In 1997, he joined the Center for Legal Action on Human Rights in Guatemala City and served as its legal director for 4 years. His academic background includes education at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome, where he received a degree in philosophy, and at Glasgow University, Scotland, where he received a Master of Arts in Spanish and Italian and an honors degree in law, specializing in legal theory. He also graduated in first place from University College in London with an LLM in public international law. Finally, our final speaker will be Professor Kadir Amriya. Professor Amriya serves as a professor at George Washington University with over 20 years' experience in teaching and practicing international law, Islamic law, international affairs, comparative politics, and government. He serves as a member of the executive committee of the Cyprus Peace Movement for Afghanistan. as a board member on the Council of Cooperation for Afghan National Organizations, vice chair of the National Advisory Council for South Asian Affairs, and a founding member of the Central Asia Research and Development Center. He served, importantly, as one of the delegates to the UN conference in Bonn, Germany, in 2001 that resulted in the negotiations to establish the new government in Afghanistan. In the mid-1990s, he served as legal consultant to the U.S. Agency for International Development to assist in the electoral law and constitution drafts for Tajikistan. He is widely published on many subjects, including, of course, Afghanistan, has testified before Congress on a variety of topics. He is a graduate of the Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand, School of Law and Diplomacy, Kabul University, Afghanistan, and George Washington University. And with that, I'd like to turn the mic over to Jamal.
Good morning to everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me to join this gathering. I was in Kabul for a month recently, and I would like to share with you some of my impressions and tell you a little bit about a bit of the overall picture when it comes to the justice sector and the work that is going on. I will be brief. My colleagues here in the panel will deal with various aspects, but let me say, you know, a few things as a way of introduction. First, as you may recall, the Bonn Agreement included one very specific clause calling for the rebuilding of the justice system in Afghanistan and called for the setting up of a commission to carry out this task. And I was in Kabul, Afghanistan, in connection with the work of the UN in assisting the new authorities establishing this commission and other commissions. In the Bonn Agreement, it was clearly indicated that these commissions, Human Rights Commission, Lawyer Jurgen Commission, Justice Commission, would be established with the assistance of the UN, and the United Nations right now is very busy providing this kind of assistance. Now, work has advanced in the political front, and the Lawyer Jurgen Commission has been established, the political process is underway, and it looks very promising. It was only something like 30 minutes ago when I talked to a colleague, UN colleague in Kabul, to get the latest impressions, and all the signs are really encouraging. It was felt also that, to some extent, assistance to the justice sector was lagging a little bit behind. And this is the reason why I was there, mandated specifically to help the authorities develop some options, some ideas on how best to set up this judicial commission. But first, let me tell you about a few other impressions based on the dozens of meetings that I had with groups of judges, groups of prosecutors, the law faculty in Kabul, women jurists in Kabul, and so on. We had a consultative process that consisted of a number of workshops, half-day workshops, focusing on discussing the overall picture, but also coming up with some specific ideas on how best to move forward in the justice sector and how best to set up this judicial commission. First, one thing that you need to keep in mind is that the justice sector now in Afghanistan is very much segmented. It's comprised of small islands unconnected with each other, and let me explain this a bit more. There is a Ministry of Justice with very limited powers. Powers are limited to basically juvenile justice and legislation. A Ministry of Justice that is in conflict openly with the Supreme Court. A Supreme Court that is very well established, and it's very much dominated by very conservative Supreme Court justices and a Supreme Court Chief Justice, who are all in turn having the least they can say communications or serious problems with the Attorney General, what is called the Attorney General in Afghanistan, and that's basically the prosecution. And all this, no connection whatsoever to all the work that has been done in the law enforcement area, which is carried out under the Ministry of the Interior. One impression that you get very easily is that focus has been on law enforcement, on the setting up of the new national police and the debate about the national army and the security sector in general, including issues such as the demobilization of and reintegration of the combatants who are currently part of the various armed factions. But you have the clear impression also that there is no clear plan, comprehensive plan in this area, and there is no evidence whatsoever on any reform strategy when it comes to the justice sector. What you find is different interlocutors, different islands unconnected with each other, and no overall forum in which justice reform issues can even be discussed. This makes it very imperative that the Justice Commission, the Judicial Commission, be established. The Bonn agreements gave a very broad mandate to this commission. It's basically there is one sentence that sums up what the signatories of these agreements intended to promote. It's the rebuilding. They say a judicial commission will be established to rebuild the justice system. Now, talking about rebuilding the justice system and a commission, this entails that a body will be formed to plan and carry out and monitor the reform process. But in all this, there are various options on how Afghans could go about this. And I found a wealth of ideas and options that were all discussed during this consultative process that the UN organized in Kabul. So the first question was really what should be the exact mandate of this commission, what should be its functions, substantive issues that will come under its jurisdiction. Various views, but by the end of 1 month there was one consensus that emerged, which is that first of all it should play what they would call in a nutshell, you know, a law reform commission function first, which is the analysis, clarification and dissemination of applicable law. Here my colleague can tell you a number of anecdotes. There is a great deal of confusion about applicable laws. Laws themselves are not easily available. You are in the Ministry of Justice and you find the minister hassled with lots of calls, people asking to have a copy, to acquire a copy of the civil code, because there are basically no copies available to most jurists in Afghanistan. But other issues that, you know, the commission will need to deal with is promoting law reform to ensure that the legal framework is consistent with international human rights standards. In the language that appears in the Bonn Agreement, it says legal framework consistent with international norms and standards, Islamic principles broadly defined, and the Afghan legal tradition. So basically it's a commission that will prepare the country, the legal framework, to be a bit up to date and to the societal needs of the 21st century. Here, let me stress that there is a sophisticated and comprehensive body of laws in Afghanistan. This is a country with a long legal tradition. It's a country that's produced very eminent jurists. It's a country that has a criminal code, a code of criminal procedure. For example, if you look at them, you will get the clear impression that was very much advanced, knowing that this has developed in the 60s, and even if just the same laws are applied now and procedures, I don't think that there are major problems that Afghanistan cannot live with. But however, as the needs have, as society has developed, you know, there is a need for a comprehensive view and revision to all these laws and so on, and this will be the function of the Judicial Commission. So it's a commission that will remove defects in the law, simplify the law, and adopt new and more effective, efficient methods for administering the law and dispensing justice. But again, let me tell you here, having said this, that there is a comprehensive body of laws in Afghanistan. Many of them are really need urgent updating, and I will give you just two examples. Drugs. The drug issues are very high on the agenda. I had an opportunity to look at the text, which dates 1990, about the prohibition of drugs in Afghanistan, and it has some very serious defects. For example, it doesn't distinguish between whether the producer, the smuggler, is in possession of 100 grams or 100 tons. Still, the penalty is the same, up to 3 months imprisonment, and believe it or not, $1 fine. And then when it comes to other pieces of legislation, like the one on nationality, according to the current laws, the spouse of a foreigner may not work in the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, cannot be a cabinet member, and this is something that needs urgent revision, knowing that Afghans have lived now during the decades of civil war in diaspora and acquired other nationalities. And in fact, right now, it seems that members of the current administration themselves have other passports and so on, but everybody agrees that this is an area that needs to be looked into, and if we don't address this issue, we'll have a lot of Afghan expertise that resides abroad now will not be able to go back and contribute to the rebuilding of Afghanistan. So I talked very briefly about the need for revising the legal framework, but also one issue that needed to be addressed in the current context is whether this commission will have the power to appoint judges and other personnel of the justice sector. According to the 1964 Constitution, nominations are made by the Chief Justice and to the Head of State, who decide about appointment. And one fact that is public knowledge and it's known is that the criteria by which judges are being appointed will need to be seriously revised. One fact that is known is that the appointments are not made focusing on a list of legally qualified people who graduated from the law faculty of Kabul or the Sharia law faculty, but also many come from the traditional madrasas, and this has been challenged by a number of Afghan jurists. And if we know that probably one third of judgeships are vacant and the preference is given to those who are from a madrasa's background, it shows that there is a serious problem. Maybe by the time a judicial commission will be up and running and functioning and new criteria for appointment are developed, it will be too late. Right now in Afghanistan, the judiciary is very much dominated by very conservative elements who, for example, sometimes very publicly advocate the view that they should promote the judicial amputation of limbs, stoning of for a number of other offences and so on. So that's one issue that is very much on the debate right now in Afghanistan. Who should appoint judges? Views were very much divided. You know, one group would say that we have to stick to 1964. Constitution, whatever it will produce, and another view, in fact, was advocating that nominations will need to be made by an independent expert judicial commission. It's the judicial commission that is mentioned in the Bonn Agreement. One possible scenario that seems to fly and make the consensus is maybe to continue the procedure that is outlined in the Constitution, but the Judicial Commission will need to establish criteria and monitor the application of these criteria and possibly advise the Head of State in the nominations. But other issues also that needed also a lot of discussions is what should be the appropriate size, appropriate structure of the commission, how it should function, and so on. There was very much agreement that it should be a small size commission, not comprised more than 7 members, but a commission that will have a strong professional secretariat, a commission that will have to represent the various parts of the justice sector, the various schools of thoughts, including the modern law, younger generation jurists in Afghanistan, but also the jurists who come from a Sharia law background and so on. I will not get too much into more technical details concerning the work of this commission, but I would say that there is a broad consensus that has developed now on what should be its mandates, functions, and so on. And the ball now is in the interim administration court, the interim authority court. They have to make a decision sometime soon on the setting up of this commission. This is very important in the Afghan context because right now there is no body within Afghanistan that is charged with the design and the monitoring of the reform process in this area. In fact, very little has happened since the Bonn Agreement when it comes to the justice sector. The only area where there is a lot of activity is the law enforcement area. But again, this is again an isolation of what is happening, what should happen in the other parts of the system. Here we're talking about a justice system that that includes the prevention of crime, bringing the offenders in front of prosecutors and judges, a system that carries out the sentence and pushes people to the correction system and so on. And therefore, law enforcement issues cannot be in isolation from what is happening, what should be the broad picture and the broad reform objectives when it comes to the justice sector. One thing that I would say that was a very positive sign in Afghanistan during the months, this month of consultations with Afghan jurists is that there is no shortage of expertise, unlike many countries where we operated, like East Timor and other countries in post-conflict situations. In Afghanistan, there is a critical mass of qualified Afghan jurists. There is no huge shortage, although many people haven't practiced now for many years, in some cases more than 20 years, because they've been out of the country, because all women jurists were dismissed from their jobs, but they are returning now. At least one element that exists is that there is a sizable pool of people with a legal background. However, legal education has been destroyed by the Taliban. And one little footnote again, I found to my big surprise, I think most people don't know this, I didn't know this myself until I went to Afghanistan, all law books were burned by the Taliban. There is no decent law library in the country. They burnt all the law books at the law faculty, in the Ministry of Justice, in the Attorney General's office. Jurists do not have, as I said earlier, do not have even copies of the laws, but they don't have any law books at all. Second, it's very difficult to talk to Afghan authorities and the judicial authorities, for example, about substantive issues when you can hardly find any rooms that are equipped with stationery and chairs and tables and so on. The only offices that you find that are a bit equipped are the specific office of the Attorney General or the Chief Justice or the Minister of Justice. When you walk around the other buildings, you find that basic infrastructure is not there. And that makes it very difficult, you know, to start engaging the authorities in more substantive issues. So this kind of assistance is very urgent, it's very important. And without it, you cannot that advance. This coupled with the setting up of a body, I mentioned the Judicial Commission, that could bring some coherence and help develop a strategy with the buy-in from this different segmented system, you know, that exists. But I think I will stop here. I will give some more information, maybe answering other questions, and I'm sure that my colleagues will have more to say on the current situation in Afghanistan vis-à-vis the justice sector. But one thing I want to stress, you know, again, in terms of what the international community is doing, one, I see something new that I haven't seen in other post-conflict situations. The international community is not descending the country with the hundreds of thousands of cars and international personnel the way we saw them in places like Haiti, Guatemala, or El Salvador, or other post-conflict situations like Rwanda, South Africa, and so on. There is a very concerted effort, you know, from the international community to promote genuine participation in this process. That's something that is new to me that I haven't seen in many other post-conflict situations. And this applies also to this area that we are talking about. The international community is not going to administer justice in Afghanistan. The Afghans will need to do this themselves. And the role of the international community will be a facilitator role, a supportive role. It's very easy for the international community to start exporting judges and prosecutors to Afghanistan, but that will not fly, and we know how difficult it's been in some other countries where the international community attempted to do this, like in Kosovo or East Timor. Second, I spoke about, an effort to promote genuine participation, but there is also a genuine effort to ensure ownership. This commission could have been established several months ago. The UN could have, since the Bonn Agreement says assistance is to be set up through assistance, UN assistance, the UN could have submitted terms of reference and a list of names to the authorities and press the authorities to make the announcement. We decided not to do this. We decided that the best course of action would be to help develop a dialogue among the Afghans on how best to address the reform process in the justice sector. It is taking time, but there is a consensus that is developing. There is ownership here that is developing on how best Afghans should address this issue, and we are playing only a supportive role in this area. I think I will stop here and we'll deal with other issues later on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Two quick notes. One, I should have mentioned at the outset, we're joined, in addition to those in the room, by those elsewhere joining in by the World Wide Web. And as indicated in the webcast, any of you who wish to submit questions in writing for the panel are invited to do so. I would also note Pride, I guess, on part of the Institute, when we started working on these issues back in the fall and raising a number of questions, one of the primary recommendations that we made in the report that you see outside to the negotiators in Bonn was for the establishment of the Judicial Affairs Commission with a framework that hopefully will inform the establishment of the body, and obviously it's gratifying to see that aspect forward. Lisa, please.
Thank you. Well, I was part of the consortium for response to the Afghanistan transition. This is a consortium that was formed by four different organizations, the International Foundation for Election Systems, the International Human Rights Law Group, the American Bar Association, and the International Resources Group. And the purpose was to really take a look at where Afghanistan stands in the areas of rule of law, governance, and human rights, and to try to provide really a starting point for the assistance and the activities that would be going on in these areas in the future. And as part of this project, we traveled to Kabul in February and March, and a copy of our report is outside on the table. It's called Filling the Vacuum, Prerequisites to Security in Afghanistan. And as Neil said in his introduction, the basic point was that security requires a number of different elements in order to exist, And it doesn't just exist because you have security at gunpoint. You have to have indigenous systems that can provide for longer-term security according to the traditions and the needs of the country. And in that vein, the real bottom line of the report is that these systems of rule of law, governance, and human rights need to be developed, and they need to be developed now, that you cannot wait for further political developments to occur. And in that regard, you know, Jamal has given a very good overview of sort of what is happening at this point, and what I thought I could do is provide a little bit of context and background on that, and then I'd like to just speak about a couple of themes that we felt were important in coming out of Kabul and after talking to many folks on the ground there. First of all, under the Bonn Agreement, it provides that in terms of the justice sector, that the 1964 Constitution is the governing constitution at this point, to the extent that it is compatible with international obligations and compatible with the Bonn Agreement. And the 1964 Constitution was adopted under Zahir Shah. It was regarded at the time of its adoption as one of the most progressive constitutions in the Islamic world, and was really done with an eye by Zahir Shah and the leaders at that time to advancing Afghanistan more towards the West, to trying to really sort of integrate the existing Sharia law and central government law system and bring them more into harmony. And under the Constitution, a number of codes were developed, as Jamal has pointed out. There is absolutely no shortage of laws. There's laws on virtually every subject. And there is, as Jamal pointed out, wide agreement at this point, broad agreement and consensus on what the basic laws are. So all these things are very positive starting points for moving forward from this point. There does need to be an analysis of the existing law to determine compatibility with international standards. And there needs desperately to be a distribution of basic laws so that people know what the law is. We visited with, you know, all of the institutions that Jamal has mentioned that have been established. And they've been established, but they're really not able at this point to function at any level because of a lack of material trappings, basically. There's no furnishings, there's no computers, there's no telephones. But also at the most basic level, people do not have copies of these codes. And we, during our period in Kabul, we asked every individual whom we met, from the public prosecutor to the Ministry of Justice, to the law faculty, for copies of codes. And there simply is not very much. We came back with about this much material and found out that, in fact, some of it really wasn't necessarily relevant. So when you talk to, and we, you know, went into the local police station and asked what law are they acting under, and there's really no sense at all of what the law is. So this is a critical issue, obviously, and something that can and should be addressed in the short term. And in that vein, another aspect of what we found is that there was, under Bonn, the current legislative framework, the 64 Constitution and existing laws, and then the Loya Jirga will take place and seems to be on track to take place in June. The transitional authority will be established under that, and then they will begin work on a new constitution. And within the next 2 years, under Bonn, are to develop a new constitution and hold elections so that they can have an elected government. So they're not going to have a new constitution for about 2 years. And one of the things that we found was a tremendous desire and need for really getting the interim system of justice up and running. There's been hesitation in some quarters in the international community about wanting to see what happens politically with the Loya Jirga, the transition from the IA to the transitional authority. But what we found is that there is a real desire and a need to establish some sort of functioning justice system in the interim. Using the guidance of Bonn, you have what Bonn says what the law framework should be, and what is really needed is assistance in the near term to help these institutions that have been established to get up and running so that they can function, so that a case can move through the justice system. And as Jamal has pointed out, there needs to be an integrated approach. That is, you cannot just focus on law enforcement. You have to focus on all aspects of the system, or else you're going to find gaps that end up preventing justice from taking place. So what we found in the report and the recommendations we make are that there can be some very basic things done by the international community to provide assistance in the near term, such as distributing copies of these laws, such as doing some basic capacity building within the justice sector institutions. It's absolutely correct. The Supreme Court is led by a very conservative Chief Justice. There's a very conservative element running through the judiciary. But nonetheless, we had a very, very positive meeting with the Chief Justice, and he is interested in training from the international community, training on Afghan laws, training on international documents. He doesn't want to see foreign law imported into Afghanistan, obviously, but a real desire and willingness to work with the international community to do some basic training of judges and court officials. In addition, the public prosecutor is strongly interested it seems quite well organized, very interested in doing some basic training, law distribution, and capacity building activities. The law faculty and the Sharia law faculty are desperate for international communication and activity. They have a long tradition, a proud tradition, and many international partnerships in the past, and those have all unfortunately died away, but they're very eager to reestablish those contacts. And that is something that could be done on a fairly low-cost basis. In addition, the Taliban did burn the law library at the Kabul University Law Faculty. There's nothing there. There are 16 members of the faculty at this point, and they are holding classes and doing the best they can with the limited resources they have. But they're very eager for interaction with the outside world. The Ministry of Justice has a very difficult task ahead of it, trying to review laws, determine their compatibility with international standards. They don't have any copies of the laws, though. So, just starting that project alone is obviously something that's very difficult. So in any case, we found that there are a number of things that the international community can and we felt should be done in the near term, regardless of the political developments, regardless of what's happening with the changeover from the interim administration to the transitional. There's a lot of, as Jamal said, there's a lot of expertise there. There is a body of people who are ready, willing, and able to participate in these sorts of activities. And in essence, they're waiting at this point for kind of the next step in the process to take place. It's true there is no overall kind of longer-term strategy in terms of approach. I think on that point, though, obviously it is something in terms of kind of the longer term of what is going to happen with the Constitution, the system of government. That all is something that they have to decide, obviously. It's not something the international community is going to decide for them. But there are very basic building blocks of justice that can and should be begun to be constructed now as they work on a parallel track towards determining their longer-term system and their new constitution. I think I will stop there, actually, and pass the microphone on to Paul, and happy to answer questions, and I hope that people will pick up a copy of the report. you know, I think our when we came away from this, we came away from Kabul with the impression very strong of real optimism there among the people we met with. A lot of folks who don't really quite know what is going to happen next, but a real sense that something has changed and that this is an opportunity, and very much willing to work with the international community and go back to an era that they regard as you know, an era of stability and peace, the 60s and early 70s, and wanting to become part of the international community again. And we would really hate to see that opportunity wasted, obviously, or passed by, and feel that there are lots of things that we could be doing on a modest basis in this interim period to keep things moving forward.
Thank you very much.
Paul?
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you for the invitation to come. I think this is has been a very beneficial series for general information in relation to what's going on and what various institutions are doing and are contributing in relation to Afghanistan's transition. I want to begin by setting out a little bit, because it's not always entirely clear what people mean when they're talking about transitional justice. So I want to set out what at least I'm talking about when I mention transitional justice. I should also say that I also was in Afghanistan for just over 2 weeks in February of this year. I went with my own organization and with Human Rights Watch, and we carried out a very preliminary consultation exercise with senior UN officials and with as many relatively senior members of Afghan civil society and, for want of a better term, ordinary Afghans, many of those people associated with the Special Independent Commission for the Establishment of the Loyal Jirga. The idea of that consultation was to find out what, if anything, had been developed in terms of how to deal with the issue of past abuses, the legacy of human rights violations in relation to Afghanistan over the last at least 20 years. I'll come back to what came out of that trip and how it's informed our institution's view of what might feasibly be done in relation to transitional justice. As I've already indicated, transitional justice basically asks the question, what, if anything, should be done in a country in relation to that legacy of systematic repression or violation of human rights? In a country like Afghanistan, it clearly runs into the immediate and valid, almost objection, that to look at the past when the crises of the present are so overwhelming seems somewhat misfocused. I think, as Neil has already indicated, that people are gradually becoming aware that the issues of justice and accountability and reform are, as he says, a very close second to that dealing with those immediate needs, and that I think, as Mr. Brahimi has often said in the course of the last few months, that not only does the process have to be a process of Afghanization and ownership, as Jamal has mentioned, but it has to be a process that is sustainable, and if the institutions and if the systems are not in place, then sustainability is clearly going to be a forlorn hope. In terms of how does Afghanistan deal with transitional justice, in practical terms, what are we talking about? Many of you are aware that the kind of traditional and the pretty well accepted mechanisms of transitional justice will normally look at the issues of prosecutions, be it national, international, be it mixed tribunals, as we've seen in East Timor, for example, be it truth-seeking investigations and initiatives such as truth commissions, commissions of inquiry, as we've seen in very many countries over the last 15 years, institutional reform, clearly plays, in my view, probably the most basic and most fundamental role in terms of any transitional justice endeavours. I think the proliferation of truth commissions in the last 15 or 17 years and the view that transitional justice is somehow very, very closely identified with that is an issue that has to be addressed. My own visit to Afghanistan demonstrated that, as a matter of fact, not one of the Afghan people I spoke to had ever heard of a truth commission. That is neither surprising nor damning in itself, but I think it indicates the need for very serious information sharing and consultation. I noticed that Mr. Karzai, in his speech on the 9th of March at the Human Rights Workshop, which Mr. Brahimi and Mrs. Robinson also attended from the High Commissioner's Office for Human Rights, Mr. Karzai volunteered the view that a truth commission was essential for Afghanistan. That in itself was, I think, a matter of some surprise to those who had been involved in the establishment and preparation of the Human Rights Workshop. It, as far as I could see, wasn't very strongly reflected either within the staff or within the soundings that I had taken out of my meetings with the people in Afghanistan. So I think there's a great deal of consultation and information sharing that has to be done in order to understand whether or not something like a truth commission is of any benefit or relevance to the particular circumstances in Afghanistan. My own view is that it probably will be at some stage, but the particular modalities and mechanisms of that have to be fleshed out through a very, very careful process. The issues of prosecutions have been on some people's agenda certainly since, way before September the 11th. And clearly have become a matter of more focused concentration in recent times. The general view that was given to me in relation to the trip that I undertook was that clearly what was said to me was that we haven't thought very much about that stuff, to be honest. We have enough to be getting on with right now, but we understand we need to think about it and to be prepared to do something about these issues. Almost everyone that I spoke to from the national side of things, from the Afghan community, actually I have to say were very clear that they expected and desired there to be prosecutions, and most, if not all, were absolutely crystal clear on that need. That clashed to some extent with the view that was given to me, especially from the UN senior officials, that had a view that the way that might develop was that certainly relatively educated and, as they describe it, middle class Afghans would probably be disinclined to be retrospective if there was sufficient evidence that things were developing satisfactorily in relation to the present and to the future. The people I spoke to were almost all of them lawyers, doctors, educated people, and none of them, as a matter of fact, shared that view. I qualify that observation absolutely in the sense that in talking to people in Kabul over just over 2 weeks, it is necessarily an anecdotal exercise. It's hardly scientific. But I think it has to be great caution exercised in relation to the views that we form about the general perceptions towards the concept of prosecutions and justice, and there is, at least in some views, a potential difference in perceptions between what I think a lot of Afghans are asking for and what might be a view from other quarters. I want to make some general observations about lessons learned in transitional justice and something that I think could be crucial for the future of Afghanistan in the next at least 5 years. I think there's two crucial lessons. One relates to setting realistic expectations. Jamal mentioned the kind of flooding of international assistance, as it's often called, and I think he indicated that there's not always been assistance in the way it is offered. And he mentioned one or two countries that I've worked in myself, in Guatemala and El Salvador. And I think that the ways in which things were carried out there and the expectations that were generated by that flood of assistance and presence at that stage created expectations that were unlikely to be fulfilled and were executed in a way that almost made it certain that they would not be fulfilled. And I'm extremely encouraged by the description Jamal gave of the way in which the Judicial Commission has operated. I think that it signifies a fantastic example of lessons learned in the way that work is being done there, in the cautious building up of dialogue and the kind of indigenous processes that are being encouraged. And I think that's a fantastic example that's been learned by UN agencies in the last 4 or 5 years especially. The setting of realistic expectations in Afghanistan to some extent requires the wisdom of Solomon. I think that there is clearly a need, especially in relation to, for example, the idea of truth commissions. There has been, with the proliferation of truth commissions in the last 15 years, a tendency towards what I would call maximalist truth commissions that are adopting and assuming mandates or assuming tasks that really, to some extent, are overextending themselves. The pursuit of truth in itself, at least in my view, is a fairly ambitious goal. The pursuit of truth, reconciliation, and various other things all at the one time is an extremely ambitious goal. That's not to say that they ought not to be done. The question is, which are the mechanisms best suited to achieving them? In Afghanistan, I think that the need for a truth commission, for example, may well be present, may well be real, but I think the resources that are available, the competing demands that are at play, and the technical necessities that, that are required so that that can be done efficiently really will lead to a conclusion that if there is such a thing as a truth commission to operate in Afghanistan, it should be a fairly narrowly defined and restricted focus rather than a very broad task assuming what might be goals that will lead only to false and dashed expectations. And in that sense, I'm talking about the idea that in itself a truth commission might lead to reconciliation and healing and things of that nature. Besides the setting of realistic expectations, I don't mean to just talk about truth commissions. I think the same thing has to be true, especially with any kind of prosecution strategy. I think that it's clear that, as Jamal said, it's not only the political reality, that it's probably a political imperative that whatever processes are developed are processes that are indigenous, that are Afghanized, as Mr. Brahimi has been saying, that it's unlikely in the extreme that there is, in any event, the international appetite to establish either an ad hoc tribunal or a mixed tribunal. I think, as many of us know, our experiences of the mixed tribunals in particular East Timor has been at best a mixed experience. I think that in relation to Afghanistan, the prospects of accountability in relation to prosecutions, I think there will grow, there will be a demand that will grow in the next year or two in relation to that, and that that will be consistently articulated. And I think whatever is being done at the moment has to have at least one eye on the development of that process. At the same time, whatever is developed has to be both politically and fiscally realistic. The huge competing demands on basic survival in Afghanistan just now mean that it's unlikely that millions of dollars are going to be channeled into very comprehensive prosecution policies in relation to past abuses. At the same time, I think it would be a great error not to direct some resources towards that process, and I think, as I say, I anticipate that the demand for that will be increasingly articulated in the next few months, beginning in the next few months. Besides the issue of establishing a set of realistic expectations. The other thing I really want to mention and to emphasise today is the necessity for an integrated approach to transitional justice. What's meant by an integrated approach? I've mentioned at least two of the principal mechanisms that are generally kind of conceived as being central to the idea of transitional justice in terms of prosecutions and truth commissions. One of the biggest failings, I think, in many of the areas where transitional justice has been applied as a concept, be it knowingly or unknowingly, has been the rather atomistic or episodic development of those ideas. We've kind of said, well, you know, let's do a truth commission and let's have a prosecution policy and let's do some institutional reform, and we've not really seen that as necessarily interconnected and interrelated. I think that there is an increasing awareness that whatever prosecution strategies or transitional justice or truth commissions seek to do, it's absolutely essential that there is joined up thinking between those mechanisms and institutional reform and legal reform. They cannot be separated out. They all are absolutely essential if transitional justice is to achieve, is a means to achieve that end of reconstituting trust and confidence between the citizen and the state. All of those mechanisms are essentially interrelated. They will not work, as a matter of fact, and we've seen this in a number of countries, especially if you isolate specific initiatives. If you isolate a truth commission, and two classic examples of that are the Guatemalan and Salvadoran truth commissions. The Guatemalan truth commission was an excellent example of truth-seeking, and most of civil society, if not all, think it's a fantastic document reflecting more or less exactly what happened in the Civil War. It has failed effectively to achieve almost anything in terms of the implementation of its recommendations. And I think to a large part that was because it was a standalone. It wasn't interconnected. The mechanisms were not created to allow that to play into other mechanisms of institutional reform, prosecutions, policies. It's essential, therefore, that there is a development of an integrated approach that has all of the people speaking and communicating with each other through the processes that are developed. I want to conclude with two or three kind of, I guess, recommendations in relation to those two observations about setting realistic expectations and an integrated approach. The view that certainly we have developed, and I think it's consonant with the vast majority of my colleagues who have both all visited Afghanistan, is that Afghanistan will not be in a position for some time to execute whatever policies are developed in relation to these kinds of ideas. The infrastructure is so absolutely destroyed in most of the country that it's going to take quite some time before the basic capacity to actually communicate, to establish amenities, telecommunications, transport communications, that's going to take some time. Having pristine ideas and fantastic policies is all very well, but if you can't actually get on the road and do something, then there has to be a balance in the way that things are developed. I think on the basis of all of this, what has emerged is the absolute essential requirement of serious consultation. And by serious consultation in a country like Afghanistan, I think we mean not only consultation but information sharing. And when we say serious, that means getting out not only into Kabul and not only into the other main population centres like Mazar and Herat and Kandahar, but to get into the rural areas to really find out what the impact of the conflict has been, to find out what is the real sense of the way forward and whether or not the legacy of the past is something that plays heavily on the minds and the souls of the people that are concerned there. A serious consultation exercise requires education at the same time. It requires an education into the state-citizen relationships. It requires an education into something about basic human rights protection. Our recommendation is that the consultation exercise should take something up to a year long, partly because to get to the people who ought to be consulted, it's going to take that long. You're going to have to train people who are not necessarily, although I take Jamal's point, there are very few countries that I've been in where you have an immediate impression of the mental and acuity of the people. They are fascinatingly bright people and impressed, and you get that sense very quickly, and I think that's a huge positive sign for the future of Afghanistan. At the same time, there is not the technical development and capacity at this stage to carry out that kind of consultation exercise, to carry out in a technically proficient way certain kinds of interviews in relation to consultation and information. So I think the basic processes of training and execution are going to take in the region of 10 to 12 months in any event. I think that's a happy coincidence, because the institutions that would be charged with executing any prospective policies are not going to be up and running, and in any event there is sufficient political opposition to putting issues of accountability and retrospective investigations on the map at this stage, partly because there is a climate of fear and partly because there is clearly a strong sense that it would provoke instability. All of those reasons really indicate the need for very serious consultation. It allows us probably a unique opportunity in the history of post-conflict countries to carry out that kind of consultation. And I think that if we do that consultation ought to engage, obviously, the Judicial Commission, the Civil Service Commission, the Constitutional Commission when it's set up, so that there is, as I say, joined up thinking and integrated approach, so that whatever comes out of that consultation process is one that really bears relevance to the developments that are already ongoing and bears relevance to the wishes of the Afghans that they have contributed to the consultation process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And last, Professor.
Thank you. thank you for giving me this opportunity and inviting me to be here. This is a privilege to be among my colleagues, distinguished colleagues who are who maintain so much expertise in Afghanistan, and I heard I was heartened and encouraged to know that how far they are conducting their research and how accurate they are and how encouraging it is, particularly starting from Mr. Jamal and his realistic approach to the Judicial Committee and the potential role for the Judicial Committee, and Ms. Dickinson's approach for the training, the establishment of information centers, and then my colleague Paul's approach to transitional justice. These were very encouraging. As a native of Afghanistan, I was heart and encouraged. But what I would like, most of the things that I was, some of the things that I was prepared to mention, already mentioned in more elaborate way and more sophisticated way. However, I would like to emphasize a few points here, because Afghanistan, after 24 years of civil war, they need, they are starting from scratch. The Bonn Agreement laid the foundation in a sketch or a program or a framework for the future of Afghanistan. And this was produced in consultation with Afghans and with various factions of Afghanistan who were involved in the civil war. Therefore, this is a good product, this is a useful one, and it ought to be maintained as a framework and as a guideline. And I would like to see that some concepts that float around Afghanization or sometimes taking consideration of time, and these must be used in a very careful manner, that they should not be used as a compromising role for women, for children, for sappers, for the indigenous people of Afghanistan. Afghanistan was familiar with progress, with development, in the transparency, rule of law. Yes, that's right. But this is a new generation, this is a different generation. After 23 years of civil war, they need a lot of help. Yes, certain laws are there, codes are there, procedures are there, but they are from different era. Some of them drafted prior to the Constitution of 1964. Some of them were adapted after the Constitution of 1964. Others are drafted or codified by the occupying forces of former Soviet Union, Najib, Babak, and some of them were purely based or drafted quickly by the Mujahideen when they come back to Afghanistan. And therefore, there are great discrepancy between these laws. There are, yes, enormous codes, writings, regulations, but we need to sort them out based on what criteria. Secondly, the Constitution of 1964 was made a guiding document for the time being, for the interim administration. There were reasons behind that, that the UN mission choose or in consultation with other experts on Afghanistan and Afghans who participated in Bonn Agreement, they agreed on that document. The very reason that they agreed on that document, those were that it was the qualitative nature of that document that was based on rule of law, separation of powers, independent judiciary. The very concept that Mr. Jamal was referring to and the concern that now we are having, are we moving towards that independent judiciary? Are we, after 30 years or almost 40 years, are we trying to emulate that one? Or at least, if not something better than that, ought not to go back. And the other example that practical example that we saw was the formation of the Supreme Court now. And most of them are those seats are contrary to the intention of Bonn Agreement. Those seats are filled by most conservative elements of judiciary or personalities of judiciary. And those are, most of them are graduates of Madrasa, which was prior to 1964, Constitution of 1964. That was the trend. Certainly, the laws in Afghanistan, we need to look at in Afghanistan, the legal system in two tiers, because it was consisted of two tiers. This is the Sharia law and then the civil law. Sharia law mostly consisted of the Islamic law, that the sources of Sharia law remains the same Quran and Sunnah, and then Ijma and Qiyas. And then Ijtihad. Now, I would like to focus a little bit on this one because of the limitation of time as well as the enormous information and accurate information that my colleagues provided. I don't want to repeat that. Let me focus on these two issues, the dichotomy of laws or two tier laws. Sharia laws, yes, we are now, there are certain codes and tradition that needs to be followed. Prior to going to that one, the concept that I'm developing is that a state has three responsibilities in the minimum qualification of a state. If we intend to develop a state or reconstruct an independent state that should be sustainable among the 189 members of international community, meet their obligations sincerely and succinctly, and fulfill their obligations and meet their rights and duties equally, and abide by their by contracts, agreements, international, multilateral, bilateral treaties that they committed themselves. And then up to the contemporary standard. Now, there are three qualifications that, ones, that they should be able to prescribe or prescriptive stage. The prescriptive stage of laws, this was Afghanistan was helped in this stage. Let me mention the three stages, the prescriptive stage, the enforcement stage, and then the adjudicatory stages. In the prescriptive stages, Afghanistan was lucky that Afghans' friends and colleagues and international community had identical views of that one, and the tragedies of the November and of September 11 was there, and then provided a reason and a need for this approach. And the Bonn Agreement certainly reflects that one, and they help us to prescribe certain methods of to regulate the interaction between states and individuals and states and companies and corporations and states and international community. And among them, those certain institutions were devised, such as Judiciary Commission, the Human Rights, Independent Human Rights Commission, because this was needed. It was not a luxury. It was not a desire. It was a need. So this is what I'm emphasizing, the need. We left the desirables out of the Bonn Agreement. There were many desirable things to be done. But the needs were the primary criteria. The Judiciary Commission, the Low Education Commission, that was based on the revival of traditional institutions of Afghanistan. So enough room is given to the revival of traditional institutions of Afghanistan and utilization of those institutions for the benefit of the people of Afghanistan. Then comes the Constitutional Commission. That should this Constitution of 1964. We thought that even that may not fulfill the need of the current need and future requirements of international community, because it has some shortcomings, particularly in the area of freedom of press, freedom of expression, and harmony. Harmonizing the dichotomy or the two-tier approach, legal approach of Sharia and modern law, and how to reconcile these ones. That I will shortly focus on that. And then, what are the challenges on this prescriptive stage? The challenges were mentioned by my colleague from the UNDP, Jamal, and as well as by the other colleagues. I'm not going to emphasize on that one, except for the security element and the extension of security beyond Kabul. Kabul is not Afghanistan, Afghanistan is not Kabul. We are 30 larger provinces than Kabul in Afghanistan. And in Bun, we were encouraged that this was not be limited to Kabul. This would be extended. And that was the expectation of the delegates when they left, that the security of Afghanistan will be somehow facilitated and if not guaranteed by the international community, given the situation that Paul referred on the transitional justice and the issues of transitional justice and the reluctancy of implementation of certain basic elements of reconciliation that's prerequisite for the transition. Therefore, that brings us to enforcement. The enforcement stage of the of these prescriptive that we heard, I mentioned to this one, including Loi Jirga and the Judicial Commission, requires solely based on the security and confidence. Physical security as well as psychological security. Physical security, even extension of these forces beyond Kabul is not adequate. In certain degree of psychological security, legal security, security that could ensure a minimum degree of integrity, of human rights, of security for women too. Of course, this is the basic criteria there that we said that gender-sensitive approach, multi-ethnicity. These are implementation and enforcement of these prescriptions requires in a secure environment. So that part of it is secure physical security that the international forces will provide, but the other part of it is psychological and legal. And that's could be provided by due process of law. We mention of courts, we mention of no matter how old they are, but due process is differs from prior to the Constitution of 1964. During the Constitution of 1964, we emphasize the due process. The substance of law is there, but the due process is a requisite for that one, as that equal justice could not be done in the absence of due process of law. And that is absent from the process, from the scene now, and that needs to be. An action plan for the enforcement. Action plan for the gender-sensitive, the multi-ethnic society, and the fully representative. These are quotations that from the Bonn Agreement, I repeated that one so much that it's in my mind. But now, what is the action plan? Do we have a action plan? I mentioned a few examples of the action plan that should be a policy statement for non-discrimination. Who is in charge of this one at this point? As we heard that there are islands of justice, they're disconnected from each other or judiciary. But where is this action plan to avoid non-discrimination? the program's policies on harassment and retaliation. Who is in charge of this one, and how this would be implemented? Harassment of women, harassment of ethnicities, harassment as harassed by Pashtuns, harassment and the deportation of Pashtuns from Kunduz to back to Pakistan. I mean, how this could be done? Could we expect this to be done by the international security forces that are stationed in Kabul to monitor Mazar? No. These are practical issues ought to be taken into consideration. In action plan for disabled in Afghanistan after 23 years of war, there are 2 million disabled. How these are being incorporated, how these individuals could be, their survival could be ensured and sustained, and their talents, their intellectual talents. These are former faculties, these are former ministers, these are former doctors, nurses, that they were the victim of this civil war. And they have enormous talents, enormous resources to contribute for the reconstruction of Afghanistan. But yes, there is a ministry for rehabilitation, but the implementation, the enforcement, the implementation state is not clear who is in charge of it and how these could be implemented. The in auditing department, to monitor that these reformist approach is moving on, not regressing. Such as all of a sudden within 2 months, most seats of Supreme Court were filled. By whom? Why? What criteria? What was their qualifications? Well, on the one hand, we know that there is enormous resources and the scale of legal talents in Afghanistan. Certainly, yes, those might be a little bit obsolete, and they need reoriented towards the because when in 64 the two protocols of Universal Declaration were not there yet, the social and economic and the civil and political protocols were not there. So, and then these anti-discrimination conventions succeeding each other against women and child protection, protection of women, protection of children. These Afghanistan are signatories to these. What happened and how these could be treated? Yes. And then, of course, an information center, the computer, linking with the international community, if you have standards. What are the standards and who is maintaining these standards? And then enforcement. So as I mentioned, these enforcements are very essential to have an ambient, an atmosphere that would be the physical security and legal protection, and the due process of law and equal treatment of all citizens before the law. And I am not expecting that from the existing Supreme Court. Actually, the story of Supreme Court is interesting. I want to share with you when we were in Bonn that there was not a Supreme Court. In this structure, there was Supreme Council. And I proposed that to be changed to Supreme Court. Supreme Council meant, on the European model, the retired presidents, retired dignitaries would be there, and this would be something very special. Certainly they are interpreting the law, but not as much as the Supreme Court in the United States. I proposed that for two reasons. First of all, I was afraid that if we keep it as Supreme Council, this might be felt by Mujaddidi, Gilani, Rabbani, Sayyaf, and the others. That was my fear. And then the other fear was this may not reflect the independent judiciary, because in European model, the judiciary is not enjoying as independent status as it is in the United States, particularly as far as the equity is concerned. And at this stage of the transition for Afghanistan, the equity is more important, because so many things were disturbed, the order is so much disturbed, that the place of equity in the institutions of judiciary becomes very, very critical and important. And then for the enforcement, again, it's a matter of interpretation. That brings me to the interpretation enforcement of which laws. Who should interpret it? That brings us to adjudication. This is, of course, we have in context proposed. You know, I perfectly agree with my colleague Jamal, the potential that he proposed for the future judicial commission. That's very appropriate, and I cannot wait to see that one. And that happens. Now, for the adjudication, there are the following problems. I'm just trying to be brief on this one. First of all, a deep study of the Afghan laws is necessary because now the Bonn Agreement agreed that modern laws as well as traditional, customary laws as well as conventional laws or positive laws must be applied. As far as customary laws are concerned in Afghanistan, customary laws are having several sources, Islamic sources and then social sources or social-cultural sources of law. Now, going back to the social-cultural interpretation of laws, Afghanistan, given in a multi-ethnic society, whose tradition and whose culture could be considered as important. Given now that we have the Shia minorities, we have the Sunni majorities, we have and even in that school, there are Hanafis school, there's a Shafi school, there's a Wahhabi school, and there's Jafari school. Which school, in the Constitution of 64, the Hanafi is considered Hanafi, right, or a school of thought. These are schools of thought. That school was the prominent school, and the Constitution in laws of Afghanistan need to be or anticipated to be interpreted in light of that school. And now, since then, there are so many other schools based on the, because the Afghans immigrated or took refuge to Pakistan, to Iran, to various other countries. And then these, after 30 years, they adapted these culture, the Jafaris in Iran, the Wahhabis, some sort of very extreme Sufis, the extreme conservative fundamentalists from Pakistan that they brought, and then similar other schools. And now these need to be, if you want to be a sort of rely on democratic approaches, what would be the future of these, how these schools could be incorporated in law, in legislation, in interpretation of the Supreme Court, or whomever, whichever is there. But this is the mission probably of the Judiciary Commission that Jamal was mentioned. This would be the most appropriate place for that. So these are challenges for the future adjudicators, whoever it is, whether this adjudication will be concentrated in the Supreme Court, assigned to the Supreme Court, or to the other commissions. What did I mean when I was proposing the Supreme Court? Fortunately, my colleagues in the United Nations were generous and kind enough that they agreed with that one, and they proceeded with that. Yeah, now, as I mentioned, now moving a little bit more to the Islamic Sharia law, more specifically, the sources remains Quran, Sunnah. Ijma stands for the consensus of the community of Ummah or community of Islam. In Qiyas stands for analogy, a similarity or similar scenarios that are to be treated similarly. If a case under consideration could not be treated by utilization of these methods, then until 12th century, ijtihad. Ijtihad means the consensus of the community of the scholars and ulama. And therefore, that the consensus of the scholars needed to be done. After 12th century, that forum was closed among Sunni scholars. Sunni scholars closed that one, but Shia scholars left it open. And that's why Iran could adapt certain adjust to new circumstances. But the Sunni scholars need to reopen that book. And I was, proposing it as an idea that Supreme Court could serve as a place for ijtihad. In order to be qualified to meet this criteria, the Supreme Court must be consistent or formed from the following elements: Sunni scholars, Shia scholars, who become part of the qualification, and seven law scholars. If there are nine, assuming that there are nine members, we can say four of them from, three of them from Sunni, two from Shia, and four from seven law. Because in seven law, then, or conventional law, there the areas are part. And that represents the proportional population or demographic structure of Afghanistan as well. Because three Sunnis, because the Sunnis are a majority. Two Shias, or one Shia, because the Shia is a minority. And yet, when there is a need for interpretation of laws, all represented here in the Supreme Court. And the interpretation of law is naturally the function of Supreme Court. And on the other hand, since this is independent, it cannot be influenced by the government. And therefore, the Supreme Court could function not only as an ultimate court, but as a facilitator for peace and reconciliation. Not only religious reconciliation, but faithful reconciliation in a consensus of that, of all the nation is represented there, in the outside of, in the absence of interference by the government. And unfortunately now that's not the case, but I was hoping, I hope that what Jamal mentioned, that was a very elaborate idea, and I'd like to see that that will be implemented. For the sake of time, I would like to see a little bit more about the ijtihad in this approach, but time is not on my side. My apologies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do apologize for the shortness of time and for the lack of a strong hand by your moderator today, but each of the talks, I think, have really been fascinating. We have a few minutes for questions and discussions, and as mentioned earlier, if you could just step up to the microphone right here and identify yourselves. Grace, please.
Hi, I'm Michelle Greenstein. I'm at the State Department. Thank you all for your presentations. They were all very interesting, very enlightening. I have a question for Jamal. I was wondering if during the workshops and all of the information that you gathered, which seems like it was quite extensive, if you had written up paper or anything that could be shared that that we could look at.
Sure, we have. Sure, it's good. Definitely.
Patricia Gossman, currently with the Afghanistan Justice Project, been involved in human rights issues in Afghanistan for, I guess, about 15 years. My question is just sort of for everybody. It's whether you think, and I guess one thing that I draw out is I just came back from Kabul 2 days ago, and I think I was meeting with many of the people you all were meeting with. And I'm not sure I share some of the optimism that was expressed. I think there's a danger now of the international community really supporting what are sort of the safe approaches to justice in Afghanistan, and perhaps avoiding some of the more politically dangerous ones, which are also the most dangerous ones for the prospect of justice in Afghanistan. For example, right now, looking at the courts that are functioning among those that are, say, in Kabul, penal court, children's court, and so on, there are also the secret courts that are, for all practical purposes, under the control of the Ministry of the Interior, whose police, of course, are largely with the Panjshiris, who control the most powerful branches of the interim administration. We already have examples of mass arrests and secret proceedings. With the Chief Justice and the concerns about his role, his sort of efforts so far have also been mentioned. I found when I was there people complaining about the fact that directives have already come from the Supreme Court warning people not to have anything to do with judicial reform unless they work through the Supreme Court. And of course, the Chief Justice himself doesn't meet the credentials as stipulated under the 64 Constitution. And that's going to be a very difficult issue to confront, but I think it does need to be confronted if there is going to be a prospect for real reform. How the Judicial Commission, there were great concerns about the delay so far, and many expressed that they're afraid that unless it does get underway, the prospect for really making it useful will be lost. How it will relate to the Human Rights Commission, which I think is very vital, because obviously in order for human rights reforms to take place, they're going to be very dependent on the institutions of the judiciary. And on accountability, I share many of the concerns that Paul has laid out in terms of expectations and what's realistic. At the same time, I think there's a great danger of the international community becoming somewhat complicit in the arrangement. Afghans already expressed great concern about the fact that the UN, and even more, the US, is seen as having installed the current administration, which counts among its members, of course, many who are responsible for crimes against humanity and war crimes. Now, these are not easy things to deal with, but the past, depending on how you look at it, the past is as recent as yesterday, and the ongoing abuses, as Professor Amayar already discussed, of attacks on Pashtuns, as I mentioned, secret arrests, and so on, continue, the discovery of possibly evidence of executions of Taliban prisoners, and so on. So I think while the final process of how to deal with the past must rest with Afghans, at the same time, I think a clear message is required from the international community about what will be tolerated and what won't. And there is a danger now of many in the administration carrying on past the Loya Jirga. And what that's going to mean for Afghans and their security, which is vitally linked to justice, is a real question.
Thank you, Patty. That certainly gives a lot to respond to. Brief responses are requested. Again, I apologize for the time, but who would like to take a whack at it?
That's the toughest question. I mean, these are questions that need to be answered. I think the Bonn agreement is considered as a process, not an end in itself. And in that process, to lay the foundation for institutions and the rule of law for not for immediate transitional period, but beyond that as well. And certainly, as I mentioned, that psychological gap of security is there, as Ms. Grossman referred to that. That the structure of the government, there are some individuals who were at times, they were grave violators of human rights. They are participating in that. But yes, that is a difficult, but this is a process that we have to pass through this one. And certainly the past is in the present. But that was the best that could have been achieved under the circumstances that we were. Otherwise, I could have seen worse scenarios than this as well. There's no need to go to remind us of that. But I'm optimistic still for the future as far as the UN involvement is concerned. They have been very careful not to give an impression that they are exceeding their mandate. There was a mandate that was agreed by the Afghans and asked by the Afghans at that point, and there is a need for it. It's not a desire. It's the need for it. And if Afghans would have been qualified to do that one, they would have asked for it. But I think that this was a consensus that we reached. And so far, given the 24 years of civil war behind the I don't want to be harsh on it, but certainly it can be done because the speed is not up to the need. What I can say at this point, after almost 6 months or 5 months, and we are where we were in most cases, except for the Loya Jirga Commission. For the most of other subjects or topics, we haven't moved forward. And in some areas, we moved backward as far as the Supreme Court is concerned and institutions of and appointment of judges. Thank you.
Any final comments?
Very briefly, I would just like to add that the issue that especially the party raises, I think, is crucial in the idea that certainly the international community does not seek to be complicit in the silencing of any demands for accountability. Clearly, is a matter both for the integrity of the process itself and of the international community. My own view is that the process of consultation plays a crucial factor in this. If there is any suggestion of that kind of complicity, which may or may not be the case, it certainly might be a perception in some people's part, I think the process of consultation basically serves two crucial functions in that regard. It serves to legitimate any demands for accountability in the sense that it can be seen to be coming essentially from the grassroots community, or especially from a victim-centred perspective, and it depoliticises those claims as well by coming from ordinary victims. It doesn't mean there's not necessarily a political agenda in that, but it says that it's coming from ordinary people and not coming from political parties or people with access to grind. So that process of consultation serves as a crucial kind of motor in the process of energising any demands for accountability or of respecting those demands, because it takes it out of either any international hidden agendas to silence that, if there are any, and it takes it out of the very contaminated and conflicted political regime that exists in Afghanistan just now.
I guess I just wanted to say that, you know, the concerns that you raise are very real ones and something that, of course, are valid and things that we have to all pay very close attention to. You know, I certainly didn't mean to imply that everything is perfect and so rosy that, you know, everything's on track and there are no problems. It's a very complicated, tricky situation. It's multi-layered and multifaceted, and I think that, you know, what Kadir says bears repeating, that what Bond did is it set up a process, and that's what we have to be mindful of at this point, is process, consensus building, and letting the Afghans take the lead, which is really key to the whole thing. And in terms of, you know, international complicity, you know, sort of the flip side of that is that we can't be, you know, telling them what they should do either, and letting them take the lead and ensuring that the process moves forward in as transparent and as inclusive a way that can happen.
Thank you. I want to say two things. One is about human rights, and the other issue, the transitional justice. Both issues were highlighted in the last speaker who raised a number of interesting issues. On human rights, the Bonn Agreement gives clearly a clear mandate to the UN to assist with the human rights situation in various ways, including in monitoring the human rights situation in the country, reporting about violations, and also assisting new authorities to establish an indigenous mechanism that will deal with human rights issues, and that's the Independent National Human Rights Commission. It's a commission that will have three functions. One is a function to investigate human rights abuses throughout the country. Two, it's a body that will advise the government and the authorities on all human rights issues, including looking at new pieces of legislation from a human rights perspective and whether they comply with international human rights standards or not. And then three, an educative function by promoting human rights education. And the UN is very actively supporting a process that is underway now for the setting up of this Afghan National Independent Human Rights Commission. In addition to this, the Security Council resolution that established the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan also gave this mission a very clear human rights mandate. And one thing that is happening now in Afghanistan, which hasn't happened in any other UN mission, all job description of all UN staff in the mission have human rights functions. There is no one small little group, isolated group of human rights monitors working in parallel with what the UN is doing. And the whole UN presence there is mobilized to carry out human rights functions, including monitoring about the rights situation in the country, assisting also on building rights structures, institutions, and so on. And one thing that we have seen is that under the strong leadership of Ambassador Brahimi, the UN has been raising strongly concerns with even the new authorities on human rights abuses and rights issues. And I've seen Ambassador Brahimi in action also talking about to a number of actors, including warlords, about human rights abuses that are taking place in areas that are under their control. So that's one. The second thing here is on the issues of transitional justice. What I want to say here is that we probably learned something like four lessons. The first one is that if the past, abuses of the past, are not addressed, they will be there to haunt you. And we have numerous examples of that, like Chile, many years down the road, the democratization process, but still these issues are still high on the agenda and so on. These issues will need to be addressed. And the second lesson is that what really determines how a country deals with these issues is the emerging balance of power after a period of conflict. So when the other side is completely defeated, the winning side, we see it in some cases, like in Ethiopia and others, prosecute many people and so on, but we see other situations where both sides committed abuses, they are even reluctant, you know, to talk about this issue because it's not in their interest, or they come up with some compromises on this issue. So the emerging balance of power determines what happens, that's what happens in real life. And then, you know, what we can say is that the trend in international law, it's very clear, it's against impunity. And what is needed is for the Afghan to develop a national system of accountability. But it's something that is very much anchored both in international law and in the national country context. Situations differ, obviously. And what we see our role is really as facilitating a public policy dialogue on these issues, so the Afghans can make themselves these decisions on what course of action they should take, what kind of strategy and policy they should adopt in this area. And we cannot promote any model like the Truth Commission a la South Africa, that's something that maybe worked for South Africa, or maybe other people would say the jury is still out whether it worked, but something that the South African developed based on their negotiations and the balance of power that emerged during that critical period of the struggle between the ANC and the apartheid regime. What will Afghans produce in terms of a solution to this issue, I still don't know. Now, I have to stress one issue. In Afghanistan, there is no peace agreement and the war is over. There is still a peace process in the making. And don't forget one thing, the country is still divided between a number of warlords. Each one is really in control of his own territory. And the authority of this interim authority is very much limited to a small area, Kabul and some surrounding areas. And this has been basically the history of Afghanistan, which is a history of war probably and conflict between a center and a periphery, and a center that is usually unable to extend and establish its full authority over all the other regions. But in a nutshell, what I'm stressing here is that there is still a process in the making. And I'm not surprised, therefore, that up to now, the Afghans still haven't developed their consensus on how to deal with the past abuses. It will take time.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all of our four panelists for really a fascinating discussion this morning.
I think a lot of useful information has been shared and discussed on how we need to proceed. And practical terms with respect to how we need to proceed, I apologize that I need to ask everyone to clear the room fairly quickly because it does need to be set for next meeting. The speakers, I know, certainly had planned on being here at least until noon, and so feel free to continue the conversation with them out in the foyer. The Institute will be continuing to, in its series of issues, briefings, and other activities to work on these issues in Afghanistan, and stay tuned. Thank you for coming.